Refinance activity is heating up. Are your originators ready to capture the opportunity? Join Optimal Blue experts Jared Sammy and Brennan O'Connell on October 7th at 1 p.m. Central for a live webinar, Refi Revival: Stay Ahead of the Curve with Originator Intelligence. You'll discover how to surface high-potential refinance leads from your closed loan data, reconnect with past borrowers using timely, data-driven outreach, and cut research time from 30 minutes to just one click. Register now with the link in the show notes for this episode to give your team the edge in quarter four and beyond. In case you missed it, Optimal Blue has announced the dates for its 2026 summit. Join us February 23rd to 25th at Talking Stick Resort and Conference Center in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a client-exclusive event packed with strategic insight and innovation. Attendees will gain early access to Optimal Blue's latest generative AI and automation tools, dive into expert-led sessions on pricing, compliance, and more, and experience hands-on demos of new capabilities. Plus, it's a chance to connect with capital markets pros, integration partners, and mortgage insiders, all while gaining actionable strategies to maximize profitability and sharpen your competitive edge. The Optimal Blue Summit, where proven mortgage expertise meets modern innovation to shape what's next. Early bird registration is now open at summit.optimalblue.com. Space is limited, so register today. Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for timely market analysis and expert commentary from Optimal Blue. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Vice President of Hedging and Trading Client Services at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Welcome, everybody. Welcome. It's June 30th. I could not believe it's almost going to be July tomorrow. Holiday week, a little bit of a weird one. You've got kind of a 3.5-dayer. A lot going on. You got month end, you got quarter end. We're going to have unemployment coming out on Thursday, which is also half market day. So weird in a few different ways. And then obviously Independence Day is Friday. So in case you weren't aware of the weird kind of market closure calendar, there you have it. We'll probably cover that a little bit later in the market update as well. Really good show for you today. We're not taking this week off. We'll do a market update here in a little bit. A lot going on there. A lot going on in the economy and also geopolitics, and obviously with a little bit more drama surrounding the Fed. So we'll cover that. And then we thought we would do a little bit of an education session today, a little bit of riffing on ARMs, adjustable rate mortgages. So, you know, maybe you're new-ish to the industry, or even if you've been around for 4 or 5 years, you may not have seen much in the way of ARMs. Maybe you're just curious and you're not even in the mortgage industry and you want to know what actually is it. An ARM. Maybe you've had an ARM suggested to you by a loan officer. You've talked to friends about it. Maybe you just want to test your own knowledge of a forgotten relic, which is, you know, ARMs, which from time to time are fairly ubiquitous in the market. Anyhow, we'll talk ARM basics and we'll get into some payment examples and just kind of wrap about what ARMs are and how they work.
Yeah, Jim, I think, you know, the big question that is on everyone's minds, but haven't really seen anyone asking is, do ARMs have legs in this market? So we're going to tackle that question head on. And let everybody know the answer to that.
Beautiful. Yes. We'll talk about if ARMs have legs in this market. Yeah. We'll get to the market update here in a sec, but just in terms of data, OBMMI finally falling, you know, whether that is the economy pushing it or actual data or, you know, geopolitics, we're below 6.7, which we haven't seen in quite a while. So 30-year fixed conventional, about 6.65 range. And volume is still strong. You know, seeing refis continue to come in, but also decent purchase business here in kind of midsummer months. So yeah, let's transition over to Alex and see what's going on in the market. All right. Welcome, Alex. Appreciate you being here. A lot going on, even in this short week. We had some pretty heavy numbers last week, but some really heavy numbers coming in this week for economics. There's also just a lot of drama surrounding the Fed and a possible appointment of a shadow governor of the Fed heating up last week. I mean, where should we start? Maybe just with what, you know, what did we see last week and what are we in for in this short holiday week?
Yeah, no, thanks for having me as always. Yeah, just beginning last week, we were seeing consumer confidence came in pretty weak yet again. It's kind of been a theme for the past 6 months or so, just on the longer term consumer expectations. It was supposed to be at 98, you know, with 100 or par being kind of the median of the breakoff point between, you know, happy and unhappy consumers. I saw it come in at 93. That's well below the expectation of 98. And then the expectations index, which is a much more of a short-term focus, looking at labor conditions, inflation expectations, that fell an additional 4.6, and this is on its own scale, but it fell to 69. Generally speaking, and historically looking back, you know, a reading of 80 or below is recessionary. And we've been floating around 80 ever since 2021. So you've been seeing a lot of commentary in this will kind of feed into when I start talking about Powell here in just a moment, but you know, a lot of commentary in our industry of it's time for rate cuts and when is Powell going to make the call to, or rather not just Powell, but the entire FOMC board make the call to lower rates, bring down that federal funds rate. And this is a big sticking point that I think a lot of them are pointing to is the consumer doesn't have a great outlook. And this is, if you look back, you know, 50, 60 years, the amount of time that we've been in a strong labor market with weak consumer spending or consumer outlook has never stretched for this long. You always see consumer outlook dip a little bit, and then you see the unemployment rate pretty quickly thereafter follow. And this huge lag that we've been seeing tells me maybe something about the post-COVID environment, maybe their methodology is a little bit off, or you know, if this inflationary environment kind of resulted in a more permanently dour outlook for the consumer, but that business is maintaining at the very least. So I think that remains to be seen, but it's just something to keep an eye on in regards to consumer confidence.
Yeah, it's like we're waiting for the other shoe to drop, right? And the consumer just has this gray outlook, but the consumer is still spending. The consumer is still employed. It's, you know, is it tariffs and just this looming moving deadline of tariffs? Is it you know, inflation that doesn't seem to quite want to stick at 2%? Yeah, it's hard to say, but it does feel like the consumers are trying to tell us something, but they're not. Their actions are different than what the surveys right. would suggest.
Right. It seems to be, you know, I don't expect to have money next week, but right now, you know, I'm going to go out and support the economy. That seems to have been the theme, but for years now, you know, regardless of, you know, who's in the White House and what the economic environment's really telling us, because this has been from both a high inflationary environment down to, you know, relatively low for recent history. So it's a little bit perplexing, but I do think that inflation is probably the biggest driver and just how that, you know, messes with people's math in their head when they're in the checkout line. And then, yeah, just to round out last week, Powell testified on Capitol Hill with the House Financial Services Committee, pretty much a political rehashing of his questions from the last FOMC meeting. Just a lot of, you know, when do you expect to make rate cuts? And he stuck to his guns as he always does and says when the data tells us, you know, it's appropriate. So pretty much gridlock there. Nothing new for that building. And then PCE came out on Friday. Again, that's the Fed's preferred metric for inflation. Came in a little bit hot. So it's definitely hurting the argument that we're ready for rate cuts. Came in at 2.7% for core. That excludes food and fuel. Food and fuel actually brings it down to 2.3%. So those core metrics that are historically the more volatile are actually bringing down inflation metrics. But 2.7%, that's, you know, 20 bips above the 2.5, which has kind of become the new marquee for low inflation. So we'll have to see how that continues to play out. But like I said, I don't think it's helping us in the current moment in the arguments that we're seeing. We'll jump into this week. It's employment week, as you said at the top of the hour. Looking at ADP numbers on Wednesday, followed immediately by non-farm numbers on Thursday. Those are not looking super great just based on those weekly unemployment claims that we've been talking about for quite a while now. Looking for probably a 0.1% uptick in the overall U3 unemployment rate, which is a big step up. We saw it step up just a little bit earlier in the spring from 4.1 to 4.2, and now they're expecting 4.3% unemployment. So this is kind of counterbalancing that inflationary argument of we need to have cuts now. But what I think it really points towards is potentially that third of a stagflation that we should be most worried about, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, this is another area where we're waiting for the shoe to drop. Like Doge was supposed to be the harbinger of doom, right? We were supposed to see a big uptick in unemployment because of that. And maybe it was May. Now we're looking at, did it happen in June? And we really haven't seen it. Even if we tick up a tenth of a point, that doesn't say a lot. It doesn't get us near like the 4.5 barrier where the Fed, like even statistically, has to pay attention.
Right, right. Yeah, it's slowly creeping up, but it's nowhere near, as we've said, you know, where's the fire? And there's not fire. There's just a little bit of smoke, but no fire that we can see at this juncture. And then I would just caution for, you know, just continuing to look forward. Just keep looking at those weekly initial jobless claims each Thursday. That's going to be your best smoke signal.
All right, good. So, yeah, watch the numbers, everybody. Again, Thursday is very rare that the unemployment report comes out on any other day than Friday. But this time around, the holiday is pushing it that way. So, yeah, expect so-so numbers. I mean, even the estimates are in kind of in that lower level. And partially because I think we're acknowledging things are slowing down, but we're not yet in reverse, right? We have not seen a zero or negative number for unemployment, although we're seeing, like you said, those weekly unemployment claims, initial claims have been ticking up over the past couple of months.
In a further weakening of the labor market, we've definitely seen wage growth creep down.
Yeah, I mean, wage growth was chasing the inflation numbers there, the consumer inflation numbers there for quite a while, right? And when things were really hot, 21 and 22, and then you start seeing that drop off. And obviously when there's wage growth, inflation is a little bit easier to kind of, I don't know, justify or rationalize. People are making more money. They've got more money to spend and profit margins are higher and it costs more to hire people. So obviously that's going to get passed down to the consumer at some point, but now everything feels like it's got the brakes on it, whether it's the Fed, you know, kind of restrict being in a restrictive stance for a very long time, or it is really just this natural cycle that has gone on for a really long time in a positive way, right? We haven't seen a true recession. You can count the first couple months of COVID, but that's like technical, right? We haven't really had a recession since the Great Financial Crisis, which at this point is almost 20 years behind us. And you know, historically, we typically have a recession, at least a small one every decade or so.
So we've accomplished a true soft landing. And again, nobody wants to convince themselves that we've actually accomplished that. Like you said at the beginning, still waiting for that other shoe to drop. I guess you gotta wait for the long term to play out.
Right. Yeah. So like, I think there's a strong argument. It's like, okay, we're in sort of a soft landing environment. We've been restrictive. There hasn't been a recession. And then you look at some of the dislocations that are still out there in terms of like consumer sentiment versus the unemployment rate. And it's like, have we even landed at all yet? Are we still in the air and we're waiting to figure out where it is we're going to land? Yeah. It's an interesting debate going on there right now.
And I also like to flag, I think, while we're talking about the technical definition of a recession, we saw the Q1 GDP numbers brought down from, I believe it was negative 0.2 to a revised negative 0.5. So we're halfway there for the technical definition of 2 quarters of negative GDP growth. So we'll have to see how those numbers come in. I believe we'll get a quarterly GDP report sometime in July. And if that one also shows a negative, we would technically be in a recession.
The Atlanta Fed publishes their GDP now, which is like a decent sort of real-time tracker. It's not always exact, but it's been in the mid twos or so last time I checked for Q2. So I know that there's been a lot of years where we've seen that like Q1 dip and then Q2 sort of rebound, whether that's weather, whether that's, you know, just other things going on in the economy too. So, but yeah, technically halfway there, but I think at least based on what I've seen, it should rebound pretty well Q2.
Mm-hmm. All right. What else, gentlemen?
That's really all. The following week is relatively quiet following the 4th of July holiday. We'll get some consumer credit numbers. Jim, I know that's one of your favorite metrics to keep an eye on, just how well the consumer's keeping up with their debt payments. We'll get some Fed minutes for May. And then just once again, I'd like to say, you know, keep an eye on those initial jobless claims. I think that's where a lot of eyes are right now.
Mm-hmm. Good call. All right, gang. Good discussion. Let's move on to talk a little bit about ARMs. Okay, let's get right into it, shall we? So we're here today. I want to talk a little bit about ARMs. As I mentioned earlier on in the show, you know, ARMs, they've been a thing as long as I've been in the industry anyway, over, you know, 20, 30, 40 years. And in other parts of the world, they're actually most parts of the world, it's the only option you have, right? I think we're all fairly aware, at least in this industry, that a 30-year fixed rate loan is pretty unusual. you go to other parts of the planet. But there are markets where ARMs make sense, even in the US, even when you have the option of going 30-year fixed. And typically that type of market is going to be when long-term rates are relatively high and short-term rates are relatively low. So we'll talk a little bit about how that can happen. And the yield curve, right, has everything to do with that. The yield curve, as you know, we've talked about it being very flat since COVID. And that's one reason why ARMs are not super popular right now, but they're starting to gain some steam. You know, I think that there's this thought that long-term rates are likely going to be higher for longer. But if we do see some movement from the Fed, or even if we see just some more recessionary type of environment come, like starting to develop, that you could get shorter term rates that are quite a bit lower, where long term rates could remain high stubbornly. So anyway, we're going to get into what is an ARM in very simple terms, and we'll start right now. An ARM is an adjustable rate mortgage. It's literally what the acronym stands for, and most ARMs are going to be fixed for a period of time, right? So that could be 3 to 10 years. Typically, I'd call it 5 on average. You know, a 5-year ARM is a pretty popular flavor. You could have a 7-year ARM as well. And they can be conforming loans. They can be government loans. There's also non-agency, which in this market that's forming right now, there could be a pretty good market for liquidity in non-agency ARMs. But anyway, you know, an adjustable rate tends to be, it's probably still going to be a 30-year loan, but you'll just have this fixed period, 3, 4, or 3, 5, 7 years. And then after that, the loan is going to adjust, right? So you could still continue paying for the next 25 years, but that rate is going to adjust every 6 months to a year based on an underlying index and a margin, basically. And you know, looking at kind of the average ARM, the margin could be 2.25%, 2.5%. You add that to whatever SOFR is. SOFR is the main index at this point. SOFR is about 4.3 right now. So, you know, even if you were to have an adjustment on your ARM, I think there used to be a boogeyman out there, right? We were worried about when ARMs were adjusting back in, you know, the early 2000s, mid 2000s. And those events typically went by without too much drama, because as these ARMs did index, they didn't end up rising significantly, or payments didn't end up doubling or tripling as some had worried. Because even if you had an ARM today that indexed today, meaning you passed your fixed period of 5 years and this was year 6, you'd have a rate of 6.5, 6.7% ish, which kind of puts you right in the realm of what a fixed rate 30-year would be today. So anyway, that's kind of the simple math on how the indexing works. But getting into just some of the affordability, some of the economics to the borrower, right? Why would I want an ARM, right? Why would I want this less certainty that I'm going to have this interest rate for a long period of time? And it's payment. You know, it has to make sense to the borrower. The payment has to be significantly lower than what it is on a 30-year. And what could that look like? So just getting into some simple economics of what, you know, what the difference in payment could be for a borrower. We went back to a couple different markets in history when ARMs were fairly popular. So 2018 was probably the most recent. So we looked at a $400,000 loan. 30-year fixed at that time was about 4.7, 4.75-ish. But ARMs are about 100 basis points less, so call it 3.7, right? So on a $400,000 loan, that would be a difference of about $300. So fixed rate would be about $2,600, and an ARM would be about $2,300. So it's a significant amount. And that could cover, in some cases, your insurance or your taxes. So it made sense, again, that we had a decent amount of ARMs being originated in that market. But that took a whole 100 basis points on $400,000 just to get that payment down by a few hundred bucks. So if we go a little further back, go to like 05, right? This is when ARMs were screaming. Obviously, there's a lot going on back then pre-financial crisis, but there was, you know, call it 2.5 points difference between a 30-year fix and an ARM. So 30-year fix was about 6% back then. An ARM you could get at like 3.5. And that then you're really smoking, right? Then you're talking about the difference between like a $3,000 payment and a $2,200 payment. So an $800 difference, almost $1,000 a month. So really big difference there. And it's hard to say where we're going to land in this market, but we do have fixed rates higher than both of those numbers I just mentioned in 18 and 05. You know, we're in the 6.75 range right now with all these upward pressures that we've talked about, from geopolitics to military spending to U.S. deficits to all that, right? There's the long-term outlook for interest rates does seem to, again, be fairly high, but ARMs could kind of come in to save the day potentially. If you can get something, you know, if we're at 6.75 and we start seeing ARMs in the fours, you're talking about a major difference in affordability. And, you know, and then even from there, what we're starting to see already with like government ARMs, for instance, is buy downs. You know, you can get a bit more bang for your buck by permanently buying down a rate on an ARM than you can on a 30 year. So you start to bring that into the economics, then, you know, then the arguments towards the Fed, you know, somehow being responsible for the affordability crisis, but also having some power to give some relief, you know, in the territory of ARMs, there may actually be some truth to that, right? If the Fed does drop rates here in the second half of the year, seems unlikely that long-term 30-year rates will drop with that number, but ARMs could, right? If you start to see the curve tilt downwards because shorter-term rates are getting cheaper, whereas longer terms kind of stay pegged in that 6 to 7% range. And then, yeah, I mentioned it earlier, but you know, I think there's a stigma on ARMs that is probably not deserved. That some of that stigma was just around subprime and Alt-A and all these other kind of boogeyman type names that caused the great financial crisis. But it was not the fact that these were adjustable rate mortgages that we had the crisis. It was a credit crisis, right? It had to do with people borrowing more than they should have, borrowing more than they should have been eligible for, getting into certain types of ARMs that were not very well explained to people, like ARMs that were negatively amortized or ARMs with very low teaser rates and very high effective rates. So we'll put those aside. Those don't really exist anymore. You may or may not be aware of that. Like now we're back to these traditional ARMs, right? Where you have, again, you have a fixed period, 5, 7, 10 years, and then you adjust to SOFR, which again is like about 4.3%. You add your 2.25% on top of that. So again, even if you were to index on an ARM today, you'd be at 6.5, 6.75. So it might be a little bit of an increase from your teaser rate, you know, maybe in the today, probably high fives. But, you know, even if rates went to 10%, like that's maybe where you start to see a nasty adjustment on an ARM. If you started at 4 or 5% and you go up to, you know, 12, that could be a bit difficult for a borrower to adjust to. But there's also caps. You've heard folks talk about caps on ARMs. So those are adjustment caps, basically. So each year and then over the whole life of the loan, there's only a certain amount that the ARM can index, that the ARM can adjust up. And those are typically like 2 to 3% a year. So you cannot index, you cannot adjust higher than 2 or 3% above your initial rate each year. And then there's usually an overall cap of 5 or 6%. So again, back to like the 4%, 5% teaser rate, you still would not break 10% on your indexed rate once it adjusted over that period of time. So yeah, it's you know, it used to be part of a strategy for a lot of borrowers where they would, you know, every 5 to 7 years, they would refinance into whatever current rates are. And those rates on those ARMs would typically be lower than what you get on a fixed rate.
Yeah, Jim, I think, you know, the big point standing out to me is just that, you know, there are types of loans that are appropriate for borrowers in a variety of different situations. And a lot of the, we'll call it excesses of the past have really gone away. And, you know, there's a lot of potential need out there. You know, if you're thinking of staying in your home only for, you know, 5 to 7 years and just looking for a rate to accommodate you before you decide to, you know, either buy a new home or, you know, maybe you have future plans to, you know, move somewhere else. So kind of demystifying the ARMs as an instrument and talking about their applicability in the current market, I think is important.
Oh, good call. It's been a long time. That's why we're here, just re-educating ourselves even. So Kevin, I think you did a little bit of research. I mentioned earlier that it's very unique that we have a 30-year fixed loan in our country. I think you looked around at some other countries and what their loans look like. And while 25 to 30 years is a pretty common term, the fixed versus adjustable, there's a huge, an imbalance there, if you will, compared to the U.S.
Yeah. Yeah. So the U.S. is really unique in the way that the, you know, mortgages are structured, primarily offering a fixed rate, 30-year fixed rate at that. And then also on top of that, no prepayment penalty and the optionality to refinance whenever rates decrease. That's really unique to the U.S. And a lot of people have worked in the industry for a while, but may not realize how unique that actually is compared to looking at other countries, and not just countries in, you know, different places, or, you know, let's say non-developed countries. We're talking about Canada, the UK, Australia. So just taking a look at our, you know, English speaking developed nation counterparts, some things that you can expect to find if you go to apply for a mortgage in those countries. So Canada, typical fixed term is going to be only 5 years. So the full term would be, you know, 25 to 30 years. And then prepayments are usually allowed, but with some penalties. So generally speaking, what you have is your 5-year fixed term, and then you're going to continually refi, generally speaking, at the next kind of current market 5-year fixed term, or just choose to take that floating. Same thing is true for the UK, even shorter, 2 to 5 years on average. Australia, very similar, 1 to 5 years on average for their initial fixed term. And then most mortgages go to a floating sort of arrangement, or you just refi, you either work with your existing lender or a new lender and then just refi at the current term. So in a way, it's sort of, you know, unique where... So do a little compare and contrast with the U.S. So obviously, I think the U.S.'s mortgage terms of the 30-year fixed rate, your ability to refi, the no prepayment penalties, that's very borrower friendly. It's not quite as borrower friendly in, you know, places like Canada, the U.K., and Australia. But the flip side of that is, so for those countries, when their central banks, you know, need to raise interest rates, those end up having a direct impact on consumer finances. Mm-hmm. Whereas in our country, and that can help explain some of the, you know, why we've been in this situation for so long with a higher interest rate environment. There's a lot of people out there who refied during COVID who are just not feeling it. They're not, because they've got a 2% rate. They're, you know, it's they might have taken their rate out when it was 4%. They refied down to, you know, high twos or lower threes. Their houses increase in value. They're really not feeling the crunch. We sort of created this, you know, haves and the have-nots in terms of who had access to those fixed rates at that time. Whereas there's in, you know, Canada, UK, Australia, there's going to be more of a broad-based impact of changes in the central bank's setting of interest rates. So you kind of have, you know, your both sides of the coin there.
Pros and cons. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Where, you know, you can have very borrower friendly terms, but that does come with a catch where if you're trying to control, you know, an inflationary environment, it can become much harder, you know, from a central banking perspective.
Yeah. Again, very unique. You know, I've heard some advocates of our industry say, you know, especially with volume where it's been the last couple of years, and, you know, we as participants in the market, we've kind of been, you know, gavetching, if you will, about how, where's the volume? This is, you know, we need ARMs, we need these other new products. And some people would say, are you nuts? Like, we have a 30-year fixed rate loan that's backed by the federal government. Like, that's an amazing opportunity that and any other country would love to have, like, just go out and sell it. Right.
Yeah, for sure. You know, and I think the overarching takeaway here, there's really two, which is one is we have very, very beneficial borrower friendly terms with our 30-year fixed rate. But the second point is it's really not, and it's sort of coming back to your original point, Jim, of, you know, demystifying ARMs. It's these really aren't scary instruments. They're actually very commonly used in other developed countries, even beyond some of the ones that I went through here. So definitely an important thing to be thinking about if you're a lender, to have in sort of your product repertoire, if you will, that you're able to go out there and offer, because there really are important scenarios in which, you know, ARMs are important.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit. Alex, you've got a good take on this. I mean, what would it take right now? Like, hypothetical rate move scenarios, you know, what could we be seeing in this next few years in terms of favorable market conditions for an ARM?
Yeah, what makes ARM so attractive is a steep yield curve, you know, longer term, which is where your fixed rate mortgages are generally being based off of. When that's higher, if you can lock in somewhere on the shorter end of the curve, maybe like a 5-year for, you know, a 5-1 ARM or something like that, you know, that's really attractive. And that's kind of what's driving the current push for more ARM products that we're seeing. You know, that they're a hot topic because, you know, fixed rates are becoming unaffordable in this environment. As Kevin kind of talked about, you know, all these people that are sitting on extremely low mortgage rates, they have a really low propensity to turn over their mortgage and the house in general. And for a lot of markets in America, you know, turnover is not the only aspect of that market, but it drives a lot of the volume that shops might see in particular locales. And so ARMs are kind of designed, or you know, in this specific scenario, are great for increasing that turnover and bringing new borrowers into the market. Those that, again, can't really afford a fixed rate mortgage in today's environment. You know, looking at, you know, kind of the just different rate paths moving forward, you know, ARMs are kind of sold on the premise of a lower initial rate and then a dovish outlook beyond that fixed period. You know, if you're someone who's only planning to stay in a home for 5 or 7 years, you know, an ARM is probably great because you can lock in something that's much lower than a 30-year rate for today. And then, you know, if you're planning to stay longer than 5 or 7 years or whatever that fixed period is, you definitely need to be pretty sold that you see, you know, rates either staying where they are or moving lower. So I think, you know, as we're looking towards 2026, 2027, you know, a lot of people in our industry, you know, we always want to see lower rates. But, and I think we'll see ARMs kind of dissipate as a major product category again, if we see, you know, a decent clip of rate cuts. You know, like one rate cut alone doesn't sustain the selling point for ARMs. But I think, you know, if we see 2 or 3 rate cuts, I think, you know, we'll see that fixed product come back into vogue, just because everyone that's gotten themselves into a, call it like a 6.5 or more mortgage fixed rate in the past 2-3 years is now going to have a propensity to refi. And again, there's just all these marginal buyers as you keep going down the yield curve, you know, at 6 1/8, at 6%, at 5 7/8. All these folks, they're, you know, there's no lack of people that want to get themselves into a home.
Mm-hmm. And they'll have more options, presumably, if the curve is steeper. We may get lower long-term rates, but the shorter end of the curve is really going to be where people pick up on the affordability scale, right? Where you can get hopefully a 5 or 7 year loan with, you know, 150 basis points, at least less than what a 30 year goes for.
Right. As you were talking about, when you're breaking down the cost of an ARM, you know, you're taking SOFR and then adding on, you know, some risk factor onto that. And so the lower, and SOFR is based on the shorter end of the curve. And as SOFR comes down, you'll also see those ARM rates come down as well. And as we've talked about on the podcast multiple times, you know, there does seem to be a lot of uncertainty in regards to the longer term into the curve. When we're talking about those 10 and 30 year auctions for U.S. Treasuries, you know, people are calling into question, you know, what's going to be the value of those dollars as they come through as cash flows, you know, in 8 or 9 years. And so that's where a lot of the uncertainty is in regards to longer term rates. And plus that's where they're adding more bips onto that end of the curve.
All right. Well, I think I feel better educated and kind of back to where I was a few years ago in terms of my understanding of ARMs. And I don't know if we answered Kevin's initial question of, do ARMs have legs in this market? I think a lot of it will depend on what short-term rates do here in the short term. You know, do we see cuts from the Fed taking their foot off the brake pedal? And then when we do see that, do long-term rates stay high, right? I think, you know, generally the outlook, if you ask economists right now, we look at, you know, we often look at the MBA, we look at Fannie, Wells Fargo does some rate projections. Those projections are pretty high for 30-year fixed for quite a long time. But you look at the CME and they, you know, the money is betting on multiple rate cuts still this year. And then if we do start to see this recession, this shoe that drops, we may see short-term rates go even lower. And therefore we have that's where ARMs would have legs in this market, is that curve steepening.
There we go. There's our answer.
Yep. I've sandbagged it as well as I can. You know. All right. Anything else on ARMs, gentlemen?
That's a wrap.
Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Let's wrap this thing up. Good show, everybody. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Kevin. Great discussion today. And that's it. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning into Optimal Insights.
Is your
Are technology vendors selling real solutions or just the idea of them? Too often, companies pitch big returns, offer free trials, and promise seamless automation, only to reveal during implementation that the tech doesn't actually exist. At Optimal Blue, we take a different approach. Our AI-powered automation is already live, already delivering, and already saving lenders real dollars. We show you exactly where the ROI comes from and how it reduces risk. No vague timelines, just proven technology that's working in production today. AI at Optimal Blue isn't just about delivering software. It's about empowering lenders to make smarter decisions, operate more efficiently, and stay ahead of the curve. Built around real capital markets challenges, informed by direct engagement with thousands of clients, and focused on delivering measurable value at no additional cost to clients. While others talk about AI, we're delivering it. Innovation that delivers for your bottom line. Learn more at optimalblue.com.